firstly, Lord Goldsmith, thank you for talking to me again today. I think the last time we did a quick podcast, you were at DEFRA. I believe now you're, and hopefully I will get the title right, I think you're Minister of State for Overseas Territories, Commonwealth, Energy, Climate, and Environment, but at the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. So I guess before we get into some of the details of what I'd like to cover in this podcast, it almost feels like you have about five jobs. Can you, you know, tell listeners a little bit about what your role is?
Well, that was correct, just for the record. I used to be in DEFRA and the Foreign Office, but it was the same job really for both. There were a few domestic things in DEFRA, like forestry and animal welfare, but principally it was international biodiversity, international climate, and international environment. And that is what I still do within the Foreign Office. And the Foreign Office controls most of the old DFID budget, the aid budget. And I've campaigned for years to have a bigger share of that budget invested in environment. People think nowadays when you talk about environment, people think immediately about climate change, but actually this real environment, the natural environment, is crucial. And you cannot have any poverty alleviation program overseas that doesn't look at the environment. The links there are unarguable. So I've always thought it was mad that only a fraction of a percent of international aid has been spent on environment, whereas everything we have comes from the natural world. Destroy natural environment, you plunge people into base poverty. So we have moved quite a long way in the right direction there. And I have the privilege now of being able to steer and shape some of those programs, as well as representing the government on the sort of international platforms to try and boost ambition globally to protect nature. That's broadly what I do.
Well, you segueing quite nicely. You mentioned biodiversity. Obviously, COP15, we've heard about that. There was much talk about it beforehand. There was quite a lot of talk after it happened. But let's rewind a bit. And what I always like to say is, can we do a bit of a dummy's guide? Because if I could understand something, I think then anyone can. So just what was COP15 in terms of what does it stand for? What was it all about? And what was it looking at?
So COP15 is the CBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, and it is the nature equivalent of the much more famous and much better covered climate COP. So we have the climate COPs, as you know, we hosted. Not the last one was in Egypt, but the one before that in Glasgow. And this is the nature equivalent. It never gets as much attention. You never have as many leaders there. It's every bit as important, if not more important. And I've done both. But for me, what is secured and agreed at the Nature COP goes far, far further than any other international forums of this sort. Almost the entire world is signed up and a party to COP. So COP means Conference of the Parties. It's a UN event. And the purpose this time was to try and agree a package, a sort of global biodiversity framework, a package of measures that are supposed to put the natural world on a path to recovery this decade. And broadly, against all the odds, expectations, we pretty much did that. And I don't think anyone expected us to. And I would have to say that something I was never aware of as a backbencher, but I'm acutely aware of now as a minister, is that our teams, our negotiators, are so often the reason we get these things over the line. I mean, it's quite extraordinary to see our people who I have the honor of working with now as a minister, just negotiating in such a strategic, such an intelligent, totally committed way, and bringing countries together and getting stuff over the line. We, you know, last year there was an agreement separate to this on plastic. There's going to be a new plastic treaty to try and reduce the amount of plastic going into the world's ocean. I can say with certainty that would not have happened if it wasn't for the UK, if it wasn't for our negotiators. We wouldn't have got this global biodiversity framework over the line a few weeks ago in Montreal without UK negotiators. And the climate COP, even in Egypt, where, you know, we were not the hosts, we were not the presidents of COP. I think without the UK being there, it would have been, certainly wouldn't have been, we wouldn't have seen the level of success that we did. So that we are very lucky. We have some fantastic people in DEFRA and out there working, in some cases, literally 24 hours a day and trying to get this stuff over the line.
Is there a sense that the problems, some of which you've outlined, have been caused by, for want of a better word, rich Western countries, and now that they're having to do something about sorting this on a global scale, or is that very much a simplistic question?
Well, I mean, there is some truth in that because, you know, we industrialized first. So we've had a longer period of time where, you know, we very much, you know, if you look at historically, economic growth has been has been really inseparable from environmental damage. And I don't think that can really be argued. We've converted nature into things, and we've done so in a pretty indiscriminate manner for many generations now. What the challenge is to try and de-link economic growth from environmental destruction, and we know now that's possible because it's happening. There are examples all over the world of success. In Gabon, for example, they've broken the link between logging and deforestation. You can walk through an area that's been logged twice, and you simply wouldn't know unless you're a trained biologist. In Costa Rica, they've broken the link between agricultural commodities and deforestation, and agricultural commodities cause nearly all of the world's deforestation today. You know, in Maldives, they've broken the link between that sort of tuna industry and depletion of the marine environment. You know, there are countries that have done it, who are achieving economic growth more than their neighbors, more than their peers, but they're not doing it at the expense of the environment. So historically, yes, what you said is correct. But today, it's you know, we have a responsibility, obviously, with the richer countries. We know that we need finance to turn things around. It's not all going to come from public money, but there's going to be some of that, and it's important. But countries all around the world have got to get their acts together. I mean, China is a relative newcomer from an industrial point of view, but is now one of the world's biggest polluters, and its environmental footprint is gigantic, much, much, much bigger than ours. So if you look at, you know, 60% of the world's commodities which are grown on deforested land, in other words, that have caused deforestation, are imported first into China. So you know, we can clean up our act, and the US obviously is hugely important, but if we don't deal with this on a global scale, we're not going to turn things around this decade. And my view very strongly is that we have to if we don't, we're in real trouble.
Yeah, but what do you say to, and I think we always see this criticism, what do you say to those in the media who absolutely hate these conferences when they see all these people, they see these rich leaders flying across the globe to talk about the environment? I know Ian Dale raised this very issue with well-known environmentalist and father of one of the former prime ministers, Stanley Johnson, that people fly off abroad, talk about the environment, and then essentially will tell poor people you can't fly. Do you think they're just being disingenuous?
Well, I don't think it's right. Look, one, I don't much like these huge international events, and you know, I don't know that many people who enjoy them. But I don't see any other way of doing it, unless there is agreement globally, and unless there's pressure on countries to honour the stuff that they've agreed to. We're just not going to do it. And there is a lot of pressure that is applied in these international forums. Countries that are really reluctant find themselves kind of pressured to get on board. And the pressure isn't coming from the rich leaders. It sometimes is, but on the whole, it's not. Mostly the pressure. So, for example, at the climate COP, the loudest voice and the biggest kind of moral pressure that was applied came from the small island states. Many of them are Commonwealth members. You know, in the Pacific, these islands for whom climate change is an existential issue. There's no debate going on in Fiji or Palau or Samoa or the Solomon Islands about whether or not climate change is happening. They feel it, they see it, they know what's happening, and they know that it's not good news for them. So for them, this is an existential issue, and they are increasingly the main source of pressure. And just to put that in context, you know, there was a moment a few months ago where the UK, where there were rumors that the UK was going to backtrack on some of the commitments we made at COP26 in Glasgow, commitments that we secured globally, but the rumors that we ourselves were going to start backing off from some of those commitments, including in terms of finance for small island states and third world countries and so on. And the message from Commonwealth members, particularly small island states that are members of the Commonwealth, to us was brutal. It was, you know, you have made us a promise on something which is the biggest issue of all for us. If you break it, that will jeopardize our relationship forever. Yeah. And the subtext there is that, you know, we know that the countries like China are doing everything they can to woo and court these small island states. They've got the same power internationally as we have when it comes to voting in the UN. You know, it's in everyone's interests that those islands side with us when it comes to voting on the big issues like Russia, Ukraine. And the message to us was not implicit, but it was, sorry, it was not explicit, but it was certainly implicit. And that is that, you know, you mess us around on this stuff and our loyalty to you, our friendship with you, your favored partnership status is under threat. And from terms of geopolitics, that stuff obviously really, really does matter. So I don't think it is about rich countries wagging their fingers at all. I think in many respects, rich countries are being dragged into a position of ambition and action.
Now you've already touched upon how essentially, you know, these issues are global issues. They're just massive, massive issues. It sometimes feels like when an issue's that big, there's nothing that an individual can do. What do you say to somebody at home here in the UK? You know, what should they be doing?
Well, I think reaching the agreements that we've reached are obviously global, and that's done at a leader level, and we've got all the countries have their negotiators and so on and so forth. But then countries, once they've agreed these things, have to make them real. And a lot of that stuff is not global. It's local. It's you know, stuff that you and I and everyone else does on a daily basis. And part of that's stuff that is directly in our control. You know, if you're lucky enough to own a garden or a piece of land, the way you manage that land can have massive implications for nature. We have make choices in what we buy and what we do and what we eat. Some of it is not global, but it's not individual quite like that. And you know, there are policy changes that governments can make that have a massive impact. You know, we are currently the only country in the world, but we know that'll change this year, and many others will do the same, but we've legislated to prohibit the import of commodities, agricultural commodities that have been grown on illegally deforested land. Now, when that becomes, when that is enacted, which should be towards the end of this year, that'll have a massive impact in terms of reducing our footprint. So, you know, when you or I go to the supermarket and buy stuff that has agricultural commodities in it, we're buying imported deforestation. We are contributing directly. It's not our fault. We don't choose to, but it's what happens as a consequence of our national environmental footprint, our supply chains. But if other countries do what the UK is doing, and we know the European Union is now doing it, we know the Americans, there's a bill making its way slowly through their system. That's the kind of stuff that is quite boring. It's not going to get any headlines, but it has a massive impact in terms of reducing our environmental footprint. And it doesn't come with additional cost. You know, as I said, we know that Brazil can, if they want, produce even more of the commodities they currently rely on for their exports without destroying further Amazon rainforest. We know that's possible. There's two times as much land that's degraded in Brazil than they have currently in agricultural production. So they don't need to keep on cutting down existing, healthy, intact forests. I mentioned Gabon, Costa Rica, and Maldives earlier. There are other countries as well that are very close to being able to say the same. It is possible to break the link and to do so in a way that brings prosperity to the local people. And that's clearly what we need to do. Is a lot of this damage that we're seeing is just laziness. It's just companies or countries that haven't made the effort to sort of reconcile themselves with the natural world. It is possible because best practice is there. If the best in the world became the default, then we probably wouldn't need any further climate or nature COPs because it's possible. It's being done.
Now you know I wouldn't let you get away talking about biodiversity without talking about an area that I think has much more to give in terms of environmentalism. And you touched upon it. You mentioned gardening. Do you think horticulture has a role to play in terms of promoting and protecting and indeed increasing biodiversity?
Yeah, massive. There's just no doubt about it. It's a well-managed garden. It can be a tiny garden, but a well-managed garden is one which provides beauty for all the senses, but also sustains nature. And it's, you know, what the thing that I'm sort of most allergic to is when you see these incredibly manicured gardens with the use of sort of plastic lawns, fake grass, and so on, which, you know, yes, the maintenance is very low, but there is just no life. It is a desert. There's just nothing happening there. And I want to see, in, you know, in my garden, or if I go for a walk, I want to see as much life as possible. So I think growing plants and in a way managing flower beds, or even just letting grass grow long around the edges, it just has a massive impact in terms of the pollinators and the insects, and that brings the birds, and the birds bring the predators, and you just end up seeing the emergence of an incredible ecosystem. And I've seen this with my own eyes. I've seen areas, you know, where I currently live, when I moved here probably 15 years ago, and the previous owner had really cut every blade of grass down to the shortest possible level at all times. And there was really very little life. There were not many insects. There weren't certainly not many pollinators. There was one beehive nearby. It struggled. There were very few birds. And I let a lot of it just go and grow. And it's become sort of early days, but it's become wildflower. Not quite meadows, that would be, they're not, I don't think they qualify as meadows, they're too small, but they would be wildflower meadows. And we've just seen life coming back. There are more birds. There are now 7 beehives. These are not mine, unfortunately, but there are 7. That's how much the land could sustain in this area. My neighbors are doing something very similar. Nature comes back very quickly. You give her half a chance, nature does come back. And I think gardeners have a massively important role to play. And I do think this is catching on. I think gardeners increasingly are striving to create beauty, which is one of the things that gardeners love doing and are good at. And I think in this country, we're probably better than anyone at this, but in a way that does boost nature. And we're seeing that even beginning to infiltrate things like the Chelsea Flower Show and the gardening programs that people watch on TV. It feels to me that there is a move towards nature in gardening.
I mean, I think you're right. I'm going to now blow my own trumpet, because no one will blow it for me, I'm afraid. I think the last time, since the last time we did speak, I've set up 2 national plant collections, Hollyhocks and Cosmos. Now, I know that a minister in Defra has suggested collections like these, and there are over 700 of them in the UK, which for me, it's all about preserving cultivars from extinction, which, as we know, can happen for reasons as silly as plants just becoming not fashionable. She suggested they have a role to play in government's biodiversity strategy. Do you think, in a sense, horticulture needs to be less of a Cinderella than perhaps it has been in comparison to, say, agriculture, when considered on these issues, whether it be consulted on consultations? It always seems to be, you know, and we understand that food and food security is important, but as you've kind of alluded to, if there are no bees, there'll be no food, and therefore if there's developments that are going on in horticulture, even if it's on a small scale, they need to have sort of equal weight in that consultation process.
Yeah, I'm struck. Well, first of all, congratulations. And I know, I mean, this is probably the first conversations we had years ago where on this subject. And I know a little bit about what you've done, and it's amazing, that stuff. And I completely agree. I think this is core to our biodiversity strategy. And yeah, absolutely. Experts, or even just practitioners, you know, amateur practitioners, should be part of the consultations that the DEFRA takes part in and coordinates. It, you know, obviously the focus is on farming, that farming accounts for most of the land use in this country. But you know, we are one of the most nature depleted countries in the world. And that is because of the manner in which land has been managed. Now, you know, farmers have a hard time, and I definitely don't want to get in the business to bashing farmers. And I think our farmers are some of the best in the world. But we can't deny the fact that we have denuded this country of nature in a really extraordinary way, and it continues. I mean, even in my lifetime, the last sort of nearly, I'm not quite 50, but in the 50 years or so that I've been alive, nature has depleted absolutely staggeringly in this country. And we were starting from a pretty low base at the time. So the way we manage land is crucial. And we're, as you know, we're transforming, because of Brexit, we're able to do this. We're transforming the common agricultural policy. Well, actually, we've escaped the common agricultural policy. We're designing our own bespoke subsidy system. And instead of paying people just for owning land, which is how it has been happening now since the war, the Second World War, where, you know, the more land you convert to agriculture, the more money you receive from the state. And even if it's marginal land or nature rich, but agriculturally poor, the effect has been that we just destroyed so much valuable ecosystem across the continent and in this country too. So our new system is one which is going to be based on the use of public money only to fill gaps. So you pay money in return for public goods. You manage land that's good for nature or in a way that provides access to people, or in a way that slows down water and prevents flooding, or in a way that holds water for the dry periods by, you know, maintaining the soil structure, then you get paid. If you deliver a public good, you're paid by the government. And I think the horticulturalists are delivering undoubtedly or have the potential to deliver significant public goods. So for me, they should be very much part of that structure that's been created now in Defran. It's quite pioneering stuff that they're doing. There's always a risk that it can be derailed. I really hope it isn't, because can I just make one, I know I'm sort of jumping to a different issue, but one of the things that I often hear is, you know, where is the money going to come from? How are you going to afford to turn things around for the natural world over the next decade? And the figures are sometimes absolutely gigantic. Some people talk about $500 billion a year. And I obviously, I don't know if that figure is correct. I haven't done the maths myself. But I can say that the top 50 food-producing countries, of which we're one, spend $700 billion every year subsidizing often highly destructive land use. But if instead of spending that money on destroying land, we spent it in a way that encouraged renewal of land, good stewardship of the land, we'd close that funding gap overnight. So this isn't about new money. It's about not spending money badly. Often.
So in your mind, and I'm not holding you to this as a minister, but the example I always use is here in very flat rural Lincolnshire, is I'm surrounded by farms and they do an excellent job. But I know, for example, that a field margin that is just essentially nothing's done with it and unploughed, it's been called a conservation strip and it has been subsidised. Yet next door, 10 feet away, is my plot where, when Gardener's World came and filmed, the cameramen were bemoaning the fact that bees were getting in the camera lens all the time because of the number of pollinators that I put in. One gets a public subsidy, one doesn't. Would you see a time where actually there would be value of, hey, well, actually, that National Collection's adding value, it's increasing biodiversity, it would be treated along the same kind of terms as a field margin?
Yeah, you see, I don't know how that. I'm not in DEFRA, so I can't speak for the department. But you make a really strong point, and I love hearing what you've done with your plot. And I wish everyone that treated their land in the same manner. And we see things turn around very, very quickly. So, yeah, I think land, if you have land and you are treating that land in the way that you are treating that land and looking after that land, and if there is need for support, there should be support. I don't believe that all that support should be going just to farmers. But it is under the new system that's being created. There is a, you know, the link between subsidies and farming is being, I would not say broken, but certainly reduced very dramatically. Yeah. So that if you have land and you restore that land, if you've got peatland, for example, and you re-wet it, or if you've got a hillside, which you know, lends itself to being planted with trees and you plant native trees, you will be given a subsidy, you'll be given support to do that. So in a sense, it is moving away from the sort of food production subsidies that we've had now for generations towards a completely different approach, which is about good stewardship of the land. So I guess it's a very rambling way of saying yes, the schemes that are emerging should be able to provide support to landowners, big and small, who are doing the kind of work that you're doing, whether or not farmers.
Yeah, as your Minister for Climate and the Environment, do you think the British Gardener is going to have to think actually just about how they garden? So, for example, hanging baskets are, you know, hugely popular, but they're also hugely water intensive. People have to water them sometimes 3-4 times a day in the summer, certainly in the summer that we last had. Plants that drink up gallons of tap water may be less desirable given what we see is happening. Do you think there's going to have to be a change in what we see as a traditional British garden and how people garden?
By the way, I think that is beginning to happen already. But yes, I mean, as the environment changes, we're going to have to respond to that. You know, we are. You know, you mentioned earlier the decline in pollinators. We need to start growing food or producing or looking after land in such a way that boosts pollinator numbers. We're going to need to reduce the amount of pesticides we're using. We still use a huge amount of pesticides, insecticides, and so on in this country. Perhaps not as much as some other countries, but still a lot. And that has a massive impact on nature. We need to not use peat in our horticulture. Something that I think we spoke about. Years ago. And it is coming to an end now. I mean, finally, government has taken action. It hasn't been enacted yet, but the ban is coming in. You know, there's some many changes that are going to need to be made in horticulture. Some of those changes will be a result of legislation, regulation, policy. Some of those will be forced upon us by environmental change. And I think your example of hanging baskets is probably the latter. I can imagine that there will come a point where it just won't make sense for people to be maintaining plants which are just so thirsty that they need three or four waterings every day. I think that will change naturally.
Do you think, I mean, you've mentioned the Chelsea Flower Show, and I do think, and I agreed when you said that, you know, I think in one way we're the best at the world of some of the stuff we do. But do you think in terms of some of the big flower shows, and I exhibited for my sins for the first time ever at Hampton Court last year, do you think we should, you know, be looking to see plants grown, as you say, without insecticide, without peat, grown in a more sustainable way, but also that they should be judged, be seen more favourably because they've been grown that way? Because at the moment, with the best will in the world, I could still exhibit a plant grown in peat, sprayed to death, and win a medal because it looks pretty. And the phrase I always use is that, you know, plant perfection shouldn't be an aim if it costs the earth.
Yeah, completely right. And yeah, strongly agree with you. And that I mean, I think you will know better than I do, but I think the Chelsea Flower Show, the last one, I think the winner was an example of rewilding. Is that right? I think it was the Beaver Lodge that won the prize. I think so. And I think there were, you know, quite a lot of sort of ruffled feathers, people who didn't think it was proper gardening and were upset about it. But the public voted for it overwhelmingly. And the judges also gave it, you know, it just got there, I think, with the judges' vote and just won. So it was popular all round with the experts and with just ordinary people who like gardening. And I think that represents quite a big cultural shift. So it feels to me that we are moving in the right direction on this. And this idea of the perfect flower, no matter what the cost to the environment or to our health, I think is probably in its twilight years. I think we're moving into something very different now. And that is, and I think it makes sense that, you know, horticulture should be on the front line of this. You know, people who do gardening in one way or another are on the front line. They do it because they love the cycles of life. They understand nature. They like getting their hands dirty. They're not, you know, it's about closeness to the environment in a way that you don't experience in other activities that people take part in. So it's right that gardeners are really the pioneering this quite dramatic cultural shift that we're experiencing at the moment. And it's, I think, a very good thing.
You've mentioned rewilding there, and I've certainly seen some of the work that your brother's been doing and looking at beavers and all the rest of it. But even gardeners allowing what has been seen as weeds, such as, and I mentioned nettles, because everybody seems to pull nettles out and then not realise where have all my butterflies gone, because they forget that that's where the caterpillars go and feed and all the rest of it. Do you think that kind of rewilding, stuff that's good for wildlife, has to become the norm?
Yeah, definitely. The whole concept of the weed, you know, I mean, I think there's one thing when you've got an invasive species that's taking over, a kind of Japanese knotweed type thing, nightmare. And there are other examples of that. But when people describe, you know, native English plants as weeds, they are really mistaken. They've got something very wrong. I mean, that they and our whole approach to our whole understanding of what constitutes a weed got to change. But, you know, it feels to me like that is changing. We are, I know, just in ordinary conversations, so many people, and I saw this when I was knocking on doors in my constituency. I was an MP for nearly 10 years, and people would often want to talk about their garden. They talk about, and it could be a tiny, tiny patch in the front of the house. It could be in some cases, even a window ledge, a garden, I forgot the terminology, but the focus for so many of them is about on maximizing nature. And I think 15 years ago, that would not have been the case. So it just, it's, and a lot of it's just letting nature, you know, rewilding is really just about natural regeneration. It's about letting nature take its own path. And sometimes you assist it. You know, the introduction of beavers in Somerset and other parts of the country has had really miraculous effects. And we saw that in the drought last year, where some of the only areas of Somerset that remained wet were those areas which had been gardened and sculpted by beavers. You see natural regeneration happening. It's an exciting thing to recognize how quickly nature can come back if they given the slightest helping hand, or even sometimes if we just get out of the way. We do need to grow food, but there doesn't have to be this huge divide between food productivity on the one hand and nature on the other. There's plenty of examples of nature friendly farming, and you know, I do think that the farming community in the UK is trying to get its head around this. There are plenty of pioneering farmers who are doing it. I wouldn't say it's gone mainstream yet, but it's moving in that direction, and some of the language we're hearing from farmer representatives is quite promising. You know, we heard that the farmers union was battling to scrap this new subsidy system, protecting the old system, and it actually wasn't true. It was fake news. That the National Farmers Union are quite engaged and have been quite helpful in helping to design this new system that is emerging. So it's the resistance, it feels to me like the resistance is going, and in some cases it's gone.
Quickly touch upon, again, you mentioned it with regards to the beavers during the dry summer. I because it's a bee in my bonnet, I grow my two collections using stored rainwater, which on a day like today is you can capture thousands of litres very quickly. So because I've got a big plot, some people say, well, it's all right for you. It's easy for you to store 20,000 litres. But I'll also say, yeah, but I also use a load. So, I store rainwater over the winter. Do you think in terms of protecting biodiversity in the UK, we need to think more about our water usage? Not just in, I mean, certainly in terms of horticulture. Horticulture uses a lot of water, but just wider use.
Yeah, and I mean, water obviously is central to everything. I mean, I think the main priority, from a government point of view, the main priority has got to be managing land in a way that is good for water. You know, when you cut down trees or dry out the peatlands or degrade them, you see that water has nowhere to go. So the surface speed of water accelerates, and that obviously results downstream in dramatic effects that destroys people's lives and turns people's lives upside down. So I think there's got to be a huge focus on, I'm almost certainly going to get this wrong, so forgive me, but the idea is right. And that is that if you compare the ability of land to absorb water, if it's just covered in grass and in rye grass for grazing, with land that has been planted with trees, the latter can absorb water around 30 times more effectively than the former. So on very steep hills where the land is being eroded in any case because of the steepness and the grazing, it makes sense to plant trees and ideally, you know, native trees combined with a bit of natural regeneration. In our vast peatlands, which are, you know, incredibly important, people talk about them in terms of their ability to store carbon, but it goes far, far further than that in terms of their contribution to biodiversity, in retaining water during the wet seasons and dripping it out slowly during the dry seasons and preventing drought. There's a lot to be said for a fundamental rethink about the way we manage those core environments that we have in the UK. And by the way, this is happening everywhere else as well. I mean, Indonesia right now has got the biggest restoration program of any country in the world. They're restoring 9 million hectares of degraded peatland. They're doing it partly to increase the land's ability to hold carbon, but they're also doing it for water reasons. They want to prevent floods, and they want to hold the water so that it's more available, more usable during the summer. And we're seeing that in other areas as well. In it's not quite the same thing, but in Colombia, they're doing this all around their coastline. They're planting mangroves. They're doing it. There's a different type of water, but they're trying to protect communities from ever escalating intensity of storms. They noticed 3 years ago, that when they were hit by a record storm, that those communities where there were still mangroves and coral reefs were protected. They were still battered, but they were protected. Whereas those where the mangroves and corals had gone were destroyed completely. So they're doing this as an insurance policy. And we're seeing examples proposals like this all around the world, but it's true here in the UK. Land management, nature-based solutions are so often the answer, no matter what the question is.
I'm glad you've mentioned solutions. We touched upon that when we last spoke, seems ages ago, we were speaking about peat, and the advice you got was that if people were concerned, they should, when you were at DEFRA, write to you and tell you that they agreed that peat shouldn't be used. But if people are now concerned about biodiversity, you know, what should they do? So if they think they've got something that's quite innovative going on, and you know, so I thought, well, this is interesting that I've read this research that Cosmos flowers in animal feed cuts methane by 26% on cows, and given methane's a greenhouse gas, that could be quite interesting. If people think they've got something quite innovative, who should they tell?
So if people have an idea and they don't think the government is working on it, then the obvious thing to do is to get in touch with the relevant minister, or you can do it directly, you can do it through your MP. But just to be a pain in the backside, just keep hassling until you get an audience and you can really present your idea. But something everyone can do is to join a conservation or a nature organization. There are thousands of them in this country. And actually, during COVID, there was an upsurge in membership. Mm-hmm. For lots of different reasons, people turned to nature. We had sort of record number of people logging on and signing up to conservation groups, local ones, national ones. But I think that's an incredibly important thing to do. Be part of the movement. And the best way to be part of the movement is to support, sign up, join an organization that does it for you. I think the single most important thing people can do today, right now, is just to join a local organization if you haven't already.
We have a generation now, I think, and I'd put it a generation now younger than myself, that may be quite scared because of some of the stories of impending doom about the environment. Can you, as a minister that's been involved, and certainly as an individual that's been involved in this area now for years, give them hope that there's some progress?
There is progress. Undoubtedly, there is progress. So the trends for nature are downwards. I think for climate, they're upwards. The technological revolution is happening. The transition to clean energy is happening. It almost doesn't matter what politicians do. I mean, President Trump tried to prop up the coal sector in the U.S. with billions of dollars of subsidies, and it still declined faster on his watch than it did under President Obama. That technological thing is happening, but with nature, it's not. We're still heading in the wrong direction. We're still seeing biodiversity decline on a massive scale. But we have, as a result of Montreal just a few weeks ago, we've got the strongest international agreements that we've ever had. And I think there are more examples of countries seriously trying to turn the tide on nature destruction than we've ever had. All around the world, we've got, you know, I went to the Republic of Congo. People think of the Congo as a basket case, and the DRC is very difficult, but the Republic of Congo, the neighboring country, has almost achieved what Gabon has achieved. It has almost broken the link between logging and deforestation. If you buy timber today or wood products of any sort from the Republic of Congo today, you're doing something good, not bad. You're supporting something which is incredibly important and sustainable. In Colombia, it's got incredible new program it's rolling out of paying people using mobile phones, but paying them, you know, reasonable amounts of money, like life-changing amounts on a monthly basis for protecting the land where they live. And if it's in need, regenerating that land. Again, copying the Costa Rica example. Ecuador is doing something very similar. All around the world, there are phenomenal examples. We had the recent election in Brazil. President Lula's made some really strong commitments about protecting the Amazon and the people who live there. That contrasts pretty directly with the previous government, which had sort of declared war on the Amazon. None of us can survive without the Amazon. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing some quite big, exciting things happen. And I would just say, to people who regarded as a kind of nice to have or academic, or, you know, let's deal with our own problems first before we deal with nature, just take the Congo Basin. If the Congo Basin were to go, we'd have a humanitarian disaster globally on a scale that we've never had to deal with before. That two-thirds of all the rainfall in Africa comes from the Congo Basin. So you can imagine the implications, not just for Africa, but for the world, if that biome were to be destroyed completely. Mm-hmm. And that is what will happen if we don't change. 500,000 hectares of Congo every year is being grubbed out. So it's only a matter of time before we lose it. And efforts, therefore, to try and turn things around are crucial. And the efforts are, you know, we are securing agreements around the Congo, led by the UK, over the last 4 or 5 months that genuinely give us a chance now of protecting what's there and turning the tide on the destruction of that key, critical, vital biome. So there's a lot of good stuff happening. We can't let up, because if we do, we're going to see continued destruction. But I am, for the first time in a very long time, quite optimistic. It feels to me that governments around the world, not all, but many of them, are really very seriously engaging with this issue, partly because of in response to pressure from people, and partly just because they've seen the effects of environmental degradation makes their job harder, governing.
Well, yeah, thanks. I think I agree wholeheartedly with that. I agree with your sentiment about people should perhaps go and join a local group. I could certainly recommend anyone who was interested in plant conservation to join Plant Heritage. And Lord Goldsmith, if you're ever around Hampton Court come this July and want to see some not too shabby cosmos, do pop along, because hopefully I'll be exhibiting once again.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I would love to do that. I would love to do that. And I love hearing about your work.
Fantastic. Well, you know, thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you so much. Good speaking to you.